This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 10th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 333. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, the new Sin Bin feature, and the Big Deal feature, 5 months since the October 7th massacre and the start of the Israel-Hamas war. When will it end? Victoria lawyer and Conservative Party of BC candidate Tim Thielman takes a look at the anti-Israel protests through a legal lens. I ask him about the fine line between hate speech and speech people hate to hear. In the sin bin this week, well, actually receiving yellow cards, are the NDP Finance Minister Katrine Conroy, Premier David Eby, and Tourism Minister Lana Popham. In opposition, the NDP stood up for the public's right to know how the BC Liberals were spending on the 2010 Winter Olympics. But now they're in government and they're hiding information about the 2026 World Cup. First, the finance minister for gaslighting the BC United opposition, who simply asked about taxpayer funding for the 2026 World Cup at BC Place.
Members.
Why do they hate soccer?
I don't know why they hate soccer. It's a good question. I don't understand it. I mean, people are really excited. All over the world to watch this and 7 games in Vancouver. It's amazing.
Then the premier for a rather weak answer about public disclosure of costs and contracts with FIFA. He certainly gave himself some loopholes.
My commitment to British Columbians, to the journalists, as well as the humans. That was a joke. My commitment to British Columbians is that we will provide them to the extent that our agreements with FIFA allow, and subject to any other restriction that we may be under imposed by a third party, the full economic reports, the agreements, our budgets and expected expenditures, as well as an accounting of costs after the event as well.
And finally, the tourism minister for misleading a budget estimates hearing.
If that contract were to be disclosed, I think it was probably would be the last concert we ever had at BC Place. any agreement relating to Taylor Swift or between Pavco as a separate legal entity and the artist, and the member will know this, that Pavco is subject to FOI legislation, which requires a public sector organization not to disclose info that could harm business interest of a third party.
Fact check. The Office of the Information and Privacy Commissioner has consistently required public bodies in BC to disclose copies of contracts negotiated between BC Place and event promoters, even a contract with FIFA for the 2015 Women's World Cup. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Palestine will be free.
Long live the Intifada.
Free Palestine. Free, free Palestine.
These are not peaceniks who are just want to see, you know, a ceasefire and release of the hostages and some form of two-state solution. You know, these are individuals that are promoting sort of militant activities of a listed terrorist group in Canada. At least some of the individuals are doing so. And it baffles my mind that we don't have police actively investigating this, apparently, or taking any other steps to prevent these kinds of activities from being funded and fueled, carried out in Victoria streets day or week after week.
That is the voice of Tim Thielman, lawyer and candidate for the Conservative Party of BC in this year's provincial election in the Victoria Beacon Hill riding. He'll be running against NDP Child Protection Minister Grace Lohr and BC Greens leader Sonia Fürstenau. He has written a legal analysis of the protests in Victoria since October 7th. He says that some anti-Israel activists have crossed the line and wonders why police are not taking the threat more seriously. Tim Tillman is my guest in the wake of Selena Robinson's departure from the NDP caucus. The former post-secondary education minister quit on Wednesday, alleging anti-Semitism among the government caucus.
Tim, what was your reaction to this very extraordinary resignation? We've seen resignations from caucus here in British Columbia for so many other different reasons, mainly ethical. But in this case, it's a member of caucus, a former cabinet minister, who says she was a victim of anti-Semitism.
In our press release, John Rustad, the leader of our party, has called for David Eby to resign because, you know, ultimately he is responsible for the state of the province, for the protection of all citizens, and certainly for the culture within his party. And, you know, what we see here is the party that boasts the most about its inclusivity and equity, you know, is willing to hound the most prominent Jewish woman probably in public life in British Columbia out of its party after having made, you know, what I consider to have been humiliating multiple apologies and offers to mend fences between Muslim and Jewish communities. So I think it's absolutely abhorrent the way that this has been handled by the premier. And he has, you know, seen rampant anti-Semitism rise within the extremist progressive ranks of his party and has been too weak to lift a finger to do anything about it. So that's, you know, my perspective on the broader issue. As you mentioned in your letter, Ms. Robinson singles out a number of individuals. And one of those individuals is the Attorney General, Nikki Sharma. And we held a press conference yesterday to discuss this because, you know, we had learned recently in the wake of the last 5 months of demonstrations here in Victoria that, and which I should add, have featured, you know, repeated lawless blockades and obstructions of public highways, calls for genocidal chants, including calls for an intifada, and other clear instances of hate speech and possibly terrorism. And so in against this backdrop, for the last 5 months, we've seen this sort of thing blooming across Canada and beyond. We heard last week or thereabouts from a person that met with the chief of police, Dale Manick, here in Victoria, that one of the reasons that the police have not made, to my knowledge, a single arrest in Victoria is that they don't believe if they do, the Crown prosecutors will actually proceed with charges. And as you know, it is the, you know, the Crown prosecutors report ultimately to the Attorney General. And I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting, we aren't suggesting that Nikki Sharma deliberately intervened to block any actions by Crown prosecutors. But it certainly is within her power to publicly amend the policies and guidelines for Crown prosecutors. Those can be published through the Gazette to do so. And we haven't seen, you know, any action to that effect. And in fact, in her letter, you know, Ms. Robinson essentially says that, you know, that Nikki Sharma, the Attorney General, has been missing in action as, you know, Jewish businesses have been forced to hire more security and, you know, Jews across British Columbia have become subjects of attack. So this is, yeah, so yeah, that was the sort of more specific response to concerns related to some of the individuals named in Ms. Robinson's letter.
To that end, you've written a legal analysis. It's called Hate and Terror in the Capital, the Potential Applicability of the Criminal Code of Canada and the British Columbia Human Rights Code to the Anti-Israel Demonstrations in Victoria, BC. Why did you write this?
When I first became aware of the flagrant hate speech occurring in Victoria. It was in December of just last year. It was posted on Twitter, on X. And I saw a local imam named Yumas Kathrada had spoken openly about, and I quote, calling for the annihilation of the plundering Jews. And it blew my mind. I couldn't believe that this person would have been able to preach things like this. And now we understand that there have been, you know, he's been preaching all kinds of hate towards non-Muslims, essentially telling children that to consider non-Muslims as the, quote, enemies of Allah. I have watched his sermons in which he openly praises Hamas martyrs and, in fact, castigates his congregants here in Victoria for not emulating those martyrs and for criticizing, for, you know, thinking of criticizing them. And so we have outright hate in this one individual being preached on a monthly basis at a mosque in Victoria and on his Facebook page with 25,000 followers. And I learned through more research that he's been doing so for the last 6 years, since 2018. And no steps have been taken to, as far as we can tell, prosecute these obvious hate crimes. And so then against that backdrop, you have, you know, 5 months now of demonstrations which repeat much of the same kinds of rhetoric, calls for an intifada, as I mentioned. During the second intifada, over 1,000 Jews were murdered, mostly by suicide bombings and other terrorist acts. Over 75% of those individuals murdered were women and children, or sorry, were civilians. And so, you know, when I saw what was happening by some of the local journalists that have been attending these rallies, there are videos that have been posted. You put it all together and you see that this is an alarming trend, not just of free expression. This is not just a matter of people expressing their views about foreign conflicts. This is about calls for violence here in Victoria, in our own province. So I felt compelled to write to the police. Well, first to reach out to the Jewish community, which I did in December. I met with Rabbi Kaplan, and I've also met with Rabbi Lynn Greenhoff. And have intentions to meet with Rabbi Harry as well here in Victoria. And they expressed their concerns and abhorrence. And so after that, I wrote in January to the police calling for investigations into all of these matters and received a very dismissive reply a couple of days later, basically saying, thank you for your concerns. We are, you know, meeting regularly with organizers and having frank and meaningful conversations. And so after that, it appeared to me that the police had very little appetite in applying the law fairly and impartially. And so I decided to review the legal basis for their not having done so. And I've reached the conclusion in a lengthy memo that they are apparently breaching their obligations to prevent crime and protect the peace.
Protests on both sides, but with different tones. The pro-Israel protests are mainly about freeing the hostages that Hamas terrorists took on October 7th. The more frequent protests, characterized as pro-Palestinian, are actually anti-Israel. People sincerely concerned about the death toll in Gaza may not know who is actually leading the marches, and that those leaders may have different goals that aren't based on peace.
That's exactly correct. So what you do see is those calls essentially for promoting more violence or promoting the victory by Hamas militants. You know, the calls for a ceasefire now are always, you know, intended to interrupt, you know, Israeli actions in response to the attacks that Hamas have promised to repeat again and again shortly after October the 7th. But I want to step back a second, because there are important and meaningful discussions that individuals should be having and can have freely and respectfully about the conflict in the Middle East, about the conflict in Palestine, in Israel. And I've had those discussions myself. I've invited my Muslim friends over to my home, and we've debated these issues, and we disagree severely in some cases. But we've done so respectfully, with a certain level of civility, a deep level of civility and grace. And my deepest concern about these protests is not that the individuals participating are wrong about an issue. It's the fact that there's a denigration of the fundamental fabric of our society when you have calls for violence going unnoticed and increasing levels of intimidation becoming normalized. And there's nothing peaceful about that.
My guest is Tim Thielman, Victoria lawyer and Conservative Party of BC candidate. I asked him about the clash of charter values on display in the streets of Victoria, freedom of expression and freedom of peaceful assembly versus life, liberty, and security of the person. People in a healthy democracy have the right to show peaceful public dissent to a government in opposition to a foreign war. They also have the right to expect that the roads they pay for will be kept open, for example, for use by public transit and for paramedics taking ill and injured people to hospital.
That's a very important point that you've raised. And some people seem to believe that there is an unfettered right to block any highway or bridge or other public area in order to say whatever you believe needs to be said or to you know, promote whatever cause you would like to promote. And that's simply not the case. Simply not. So in May of last year, a BC provincial court judge upheld the enforcement actions of the RCMP, who I might add do not report to the Attorney General, Nikki Sharma, in removing a blockade by two individuals who are old growth protesters who wanted to preserve old growth. And they had essentially, you know, blockaded an intersection in Nanaimo and until police came and arrested them. And this was a matter of a few hours, I believe, a one-time incident, I believe. Now, I could be mistaken about those facts, but they were limited in scope. And so they then brought applications on charter grounds to say that the police enforcement actions had breached their charter rights. And the judge, Lamperson, in May of last year, threw those arguments out the window, citing Chief Justice Lemaire from the Supreme Court of Canada in the McCann case from, I can't remember which year, but a number of years ago, saying essentially that there is no unfettered right here. Like, first of all, you have to look at the content of the speech. To what extent is it valuable content? In that case, the judge said the content was important. It was, you know, free for them to raise their concerns about government policy and old growth logging. In this case, you know, I'm not sure that they would pass even that first leg of the test. You know, you have, as we've discussed, blatant hate speech, calling for essentially death of Jews when you're calling for an intifada. You know, secondly, the court looked at the method and location of the protest. And in that case, the method and location were problematic because they were on a public highway. And this expressly violates the criminal code. And there were other places where those protesters could have protested to get their message out. Well, you know, I can tell you, here in Victoria, there are plenty of places to protest, and one of the most popular is at the legislature. They would be, these protesters started the legislature, and they would be perfectly capable of staying there if it weren't for their intent to disrupt the public. And that is why, in my opinion, there is no basis for them to say that for 5 months straight, they can walk through Victoria city streets, obstructing public highways, blocking people's road, thoroughfare, whatever it might be, obstructing other people's legal rights to use those roadways. And not only that, but, you know, shouting what I consider to be genocidal chants at Jews and others who may be walking by. So I don't, and then even if you get past those, the first two branches of, you know, content and then method and location, even if it isn't an infringement of those charter rights, there is still a provision, section one in the charter, which anybody familiar with this area of law understands, whereby infringements can be justified where necessary and proportional in a free and democratic society. And the judge in that case said that even if he was wrong, that the enforcement actions hadn't infringed the charter rights, it would have been justified because the police in that case didn't have any other option that was less impactful to the rights of the protesters than to arrest them because of the fact that they had pushed the police into that position. And here we are in precisely the same situation where, you know, what can the police do to keep the peace and to prevent crime, but by arresting some of at least the organizers that are intent on flagrantly violating the law week after week after week.
And to play devil's advocate, protesters often say that they need to disrupt in order to get the attention to their cause, in order to get the attention to their cause to affect change. Do you buy that?
Well, there is no charter right to disrupting your neighbors. There is a charter right to freedom of expression and to peaceful assembly, right? That doesn't mean I can go into my neighbors, break into my neighbor's home in the middle of the night and tell them to vote for the Conservative Party of British Columbia. So I think yes, you hear that argument all of the time. And it's because, frankly, many of the cases in the past have, in my opinion, gone too far in allowing disruption for disruption's sake or expression for expression's sake without consideration of the opportunities that there are, you know, to express those views publicly and prominently without impairing the rights of other citizens to go about their day and their lives.
And some also say that anti-Zionism is not the same as anti-Semitism. There's a lot of gray areas here that people do argue about. Where is the line between hate speech and speech people hate to hear?
Yeah, that is a very important question. And part of the, the first thing I want to say is that if all we had here was hateful speech, it would be one thing. But we do also have a broader context of physical aggression and intimidation, which I think informs the interpretation you have to make of these chants. So these are not, again, if you compare the character of the chant of the protests, or the, you can't even call them protests, the character of the public events held between, you know, the Jewish community here in Victoria, which are vigils, essentially, you know, silent vigils, and the aggressive protests that we've seen marching up and down Victoria streets with many masked individuals, and we have video of them, you know, swarming, you know, one man with, you know, a Jewish flag. You have another video of them swarming and assaulting Charles Bodie, who's a local photographer. So you have to look at, I think, the speech in the context of the character of these protests. And I also would say that I myself, as a civil liberties advocate, I do have concerns about the creep of hate speech laws. For example, I have grave concerns about the online harms bill that is being promoted by the federal government to use hate speech as a tool, essentially, it appears to me, to quell political dissent and to regulate the ordinary speech of all Canadians. So I don't take this issue lightly, but I think when you look at least at a call for a global intifada, you look at large groups, you know, running lawlessly through the street and saying, there is only one solution, intifada revolution. It is very difficult for me to understand how a court would not find that to be speech which which subjects a group essentially to an emotion of intense vilification and detestation. Mm-hmm. To me, that seems pretty clear, and it's not just vilification and detestation, but it's you know, violence, threats of violence. And let's look at some of the past cases. So you also have past cases. There's a series of Whatcott cases where you essentially have a man who is a Christian fundamentalist, and he is in multiple cases essentially promoted flyers that depict homosexuals as sodomites and, you know, uses other sort of negative stereotypes about that community, and says that essentially that God, you know, will punish them. So in that case, you found courts perfectly willing to uphold convictions for hate speech, despite the fact that there were defenses available to him on the basis of good faith religious views, and the fact that he was quoting Bible verses to back up his flyers. So, you have those kinds of cases, and you have others along the same lines, where I think courts have not been willing to say it doesn't matter if you're focusing on the behavior of the community, for example, because that was one of his defenses. He said, I'm just focusing on the behavior of homosexuals, not the identity of homosexuals. And I think there's a similar argument that some of the anti-Zionists are trying to make here. They're trying to say, well, we're not focusing on Jews. We're just focusing on Zionism. But you know, when you look at all of this, the negative stereotypes that are promoted, all of the same forms of vilification of, you know, blaming Israel for all of the problems in the region, comparing it to an abusive spouse and on and on and on. It would be pretty straightforward, I think, in my opinion, for a court to apply the same sort of rule that you find in Whatcott and say, listen, you're using this as a proxy for hatred of Jews.
That was my guest, Tim Thielman, lawyer with Cedar Bridge Law in Victoria and Conservative Party of BC candidate in Victoria Beacon Hill.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Taiwan commanders authorized to use force against intruding enemy military aircraft and vessels. Ministry of National Defense clarifies updated definition of first strike. When a country is subjected to armed attacks from external sources, it has the inherent right to use force for self-defense, the ministry said. The definition was updated shortly after U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi's 2022 trip to Taiwan, when China held live-fire military drills around the nation to express its dissatisfaction. In Kyoto news, Toriyama's Dragon Ball boosted popularity of Japan anime overseas. Akira Toriyama died on March 1st at age 68. Bandai Namco Holdings Inc. said sales of merchandise related to Dragon Ball, including video games and toys, totaled almost $1 billion last year. The company expressed shock and deep sadness at Toriyama's death, which came to light ahead of the release in April of a game based on his manga series, Sandland. In the Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kong proposes life sentence for treason, insurrection, sabotage under new security law. The government on Friday introduced the Safeguarding National Security Bill. Protests erupted in June 2019 over a since-axed extradition bill. They escalated into sometimes violent displays of dissent against police behavior amid calls for democracy and anger over Beijing's encroachment. Demonstrators demanded an independent probe into police conduct, amnesty for those arrested, and a halt to the characterization of protests as riots. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Coin TV, Hillsboro Hops announced their new stadium is fully funded. The construction of the 6,000-seat stadium will be paid for with $82 million from private funds, $18 million from the City of Hillsboro, $8 million from Washington County, and $2 million from Explore Tualatin Valley, bringing the total to $110 million. The project is expected to be finished by the 2026 baseball season. The Hops are an Arizona Diamondbacks farm team. In Crosscut, Washington legislature revs up plan to electrify 10,000 school buses. A bill to switch from diesel vehicles, plus $50 million from cap and trade revenue, passed out of the legislature but did not offer a timeline. Washington has 10,460 school buses, 76 are electric. So that's almost 10,400 buses to go. In the Times Colonist, residential school play canceled after complaints playwright is white. Playwright Wendy Lill's Sisters, staged by Theater Inconnu, explores residential school abuse and was supposed to run until March 9th, but it was abruptly canceled on Wednesday by the Fernwood Community Association. The Belfry Theater, which is directly across the street from Theater Inconnu, dropped The Runner from its spring lineup in January after dueling petitions for and against canceling it. The one-person play is about a Palestinian who was saved in Israel. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the winners of the Sport BC 56th Athlete of the Year Awards, handed out March 7th at the Hotel Vancouver, such as UBC Football's Garrett Rooker for the Harry Jerome Comeback of the Year, Canadian Open Golf Champion Nick Taylor for Best of BC, and Trinity Western Men's Volleyball for Team of the Year. You can get the whole list at sportbc.com. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 10th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 10th of March in 1947, Kim Campbell was born in Port Alberni? Happy 77th birthday to Canada's 19th Prime Minister. Campbell was Canada's first female Prime Minister and Canada's first BC-born Prime Minister. She succeeded Brian Mulroney and served 5 months in office in 1993. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News on X for news as it happens. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.